All right, please turn with me in your Bibles to Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 8. It's the last section. Chapter 8, verse 5 through the end of the chapter. This is the closing of the song. I find it fitting. We started in the Song of Solomon in Jerusalem. Solomon and the Shulamite, not married, not betrothed, well, maybe betrothed, but you know, just at the beginning of their relationship. And now we find them at the end of the song, going to her mother's home, married, their love having matured, having gone through some of the trials that they went through in the song. And now we find them back, heading back to her mother's home. It opens up in verse 5 and says, "Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved?" We don't have in the context who's speaking, but what's likely being said here, because we know they're heading to the mother's house in the context, that likely this is just people, shepherds or other people in the area. When it says coming up from the wilderness, the likely route they would have taken to get to the Shulamites, to get to Shulam, where the Shulamite was from, would be to have gone up the valley of Jezreel. And it was for the most part uncultivated land used for the pasturage of cattle and sheep. And so here, you know, she comes and we see them, this picture of them in loving, endearing companionship. Here she is, it says, you know, that she's leaning on the arm of her beloved. Walking hand in hand, she's leaning on him. Enjoying one another's, you know, company and love. The next section of the same verse, this next phrase, "I raised thee up under the apple tree." This word translated raised could also be in reference to raising someone up from sleep. And what's likely being spoken of here, considering the whole context, is that, you know, here they are, they're going up to her mother's house, enjoying one another's company, she's leaning on him, and they're doing what people who love each other often do when they go back, revisit some of the old places. They're reminiscing. And the structure of this is such as that is the idea of he woke or raised her up in relation to himself. So likely what this is referring to is this is where he first won her affection. He's pointing out some place and saying, you remember there? You know, my wife and I do this all the time. You know, when we came back from Oregon, back to Indiana, you know, we're driving around and Heidi would go, oh, you know, that's where, you know, we went on our first date. And that's where, you know, such. And we like to go down, was it Fry Road? Fry Road? Yeah, Fry Road. There's a park on Fry Road where I asked Heidi to marry me. It's back behind Heritage. It's just... It was so funny as I had this entire plan for that night and none of it worked. But what happened ended up working out really nice. Heidi had always said she wanted to go to this one restaurant. I tried to get a reservation there, but they were all booked out for the next several months. I had wanted to get Heidi a full, you know, big old thing of roses. I ended up just getting her a few, but that same week my wisdom tooth on this side broke and I had to have emergency surgery. So it had literally only been 3 days before I proposed to her that I'd had top and bottom of my wisdom teeth removed. And then I was trying to think of something. I was like, well, do you like Chinese food? There's a really nice Chinese, you know, nice sit-down, not a buffet, but a sit-down, nice Chinese restaurant in Greenwood down on, Main Street, but by 65. And she's like, yeah. So I took her there, and we went there, and it was some kind of like senior citizens convention going on. And that was just ruining the mood. Heidi likes to refer to it because there's some lady sitting nearby talking. She's like, I told him that if he ate the Jell-O, he'd throw up. What'd he do? He ate the Jell-O. What'd he do? He threw up. So I was like, this is just not the place. So I was thinking, and then I thought of that park, and I was like, well, maybe it'll be kind of isolated. And so I said that she had been complaining about her leg feeling stiff or something. I said, well, maybe if you got up and walked around a bit, you know, you'd feel better. I said, there's a nice park over on, not far from here. She's like, okay. And so we went up there, and we got there. Nobody was there. And you have to imagine this park, it's just gorgeous because it has these trees that the leaves like turn like, because I proposed in the fall. In the fall, the leaves are all gold. And they have this soft yellow light that they, ground light that they shine up on the trees. And nobody was there. And it has a wooden bridge there. So I proposed to her there. And so even though, you know, like all my plans had failed, you know. So every time we pass, we go down Fry Road, you know, be like, hey, look, there's the park. And so, you know, people who love one another, you know, they reminisce, you know, places of particular meaning to them and their relationship. And so he's, you know, I can imagine him pointing out some grove of trees and saying it was there under that apple tree that I first woke you unto myself, you know, that you first... You know, that I first won your affection. And then, because they're approaching her home, he says, there thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. And I was thinking about, like, to me, how wonderful Heidi is to me, that automatically creates an affection for me in regards to her parents and her family. Because she comes from them. And so here's Solomon, you know, who loves the Shulamite. And he says, there's your mom's home. You know, there's the person who brought you forth. Person that I owe a great deal of gratitude to. And so we see them going together in loving communion here. And she says to him, set me as a seal upon thine heart and as a seal upon thine arm. For love is strong as death, jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath the most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. We come now to what I consider the theme of the whole book, these two verses, the supremacy of love. You know, this comment that she makes about the ascendancy of love and the fact that nothing can quench it and that it is of more value than anything. When she says that if a man gave everything for love to buy it, it wouldn't be enough. Saying he'd be utterly contemned would meaning that all his property would not be enough. He'd have to sell his house, he'd have to sell all his land, all his cattle, everything he owned, and it wouldn't be enough to purchase love.
And she was talking to Solomon.
Yeah, she's talking to King Solomon, the wealthiest man in the ancient world. And she says, of greater value is love. And think about, you know, she's talking about the value of love, but she's talking about his love for her. And she's setting her value of it, of his love. But this isn't just, you know, this is not just her thinking. This is what the Bible says. In chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, it says that the greatest of these is love. And it says love never fails. And so this is an illustration. You know, we've seen over the course of these lessons the struggles they've gone through, the development of their relationship. And we come to the point where their relationship is mature and established. And she says, there's no greater thing than love. People keep making scoffing comments about Heidi and I's relationship, and some of them Christian people. Like, oh, you guys are just the way you are because, you know, you've only been married a year. Well, now we've been married 5 years. It's funny is that the same people just keep coming up with new qualifications as to why Heidi and I are so happy. That it has nothing to do with the fact that we pursue in our relationship the biblical model of love. They try to keep coming up with other reasons. My brother said that one time, he said, I was a virtuous man just because I had never been with a woman. I was like, and now that I'm married, it's because I've only ever been with one. It's never going to be his fault, is the thing. And you know, that's one of the things that I think is the hardest thing for people to do, is to say, I am responsible for the choices I made. I am responsible for the situation I'm in. I made choices. I was counseling with a young man. I said, you need to get to the point where you say like Job. Oh man, I just forgot. I'm going to have to paraphrase, I'm sorry. It's like, I have chosen that which is wrong, and it has profited me nothing. You know, we need to come to the point where we take responsibility for our choices. My wife and I have enjoyed a tremendous relationship that is amazing considering both of our family backgrounds. Her parents are divorced. My parents have been separated repeatedly and fight horrendously. If you ever think I'm exaggerating about my parents, please talk to Heidi. She lived with them. We stayed with them for several weeks, so she knows what they're like. There are people who challenge these statements, said that love never fails. They're like, well, love failed in my life. No, you abandoned love. You turned away from the path of love. That does not mean that love failed. That'd be like saying, well, that drug you prescribed, doctor, didn't work. Well, how long did you take it? 2 days. But I prescribed it for 10. Well, I didn't want to take it anymore. It was nasty, hard to swallow. Those pills are huge. It'd be the same thing. How often people blame, you know, say love failed. No, love didn't fail. They just stopped loving. They abandoned love. Love is an all-conquering thing. That when we follow the path of love, it produces a great good. And that's why she calls on him in verse 6. She says, set me as a seal upon your breast and as a seal upon your arm. You know, she's saying, hold me close to your heart. Encircle me, you know, with your arms. Hold me there. Because love is powerful. Love can protect us, keep us from sin. Keep us from the dangers of the flesh. In verse 8, we have a change here, kind of a skip, because in verses 5 through 7, we see them walking and talking, but verse 8, we're now at her mother's home. And it appears that she's speaking to her brothers. Says, we have a little sister, and she hath no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for? If she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. And if she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. I am a wall and my breast like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. In this poetic thing they're talking about here, is likely what this is referring to is of what it was like when the Shulamite was a girl. I was sharing in the lobby that one of the things that came out in my studies is that often in the Middle East custom among the Jews and others was that the duty of watching over the young woman in the family, protecting her purity, was that of the brothers, not so much the father. The brothers were in charge of making sure their sister was protected. And this is seeming to be discussing about how it came to the point that that Solomon found her such a pure, upright young woman. This phrase, if she be a wall, it's referring to this, whether she's a wall or whether she's a door, referring to her tendency to being morally susceptible to temptation. And they said that if she's a wall, if she's morally strong and virtuous, they said we will build on her towers of silver. This is the idea of showering on her honor and lifting her up. They said, but if she be a door, one given to temptation, they said, we'll board her up. We'll cover her with boards. We'll block that door. I was sharing with Brother Voorhees. I have a sister. I have a brother and a sister. My brother is the oldest. I'm the youngest. And when my sister came of an age that boys really started noticing her, there was this one young man we didn't want around. And my brother and I, talking about it, realized that talking to her was going to be a waste of time. So we went straight to the young man and we told him, you need to go away now. And we told him, if you don't, or if our sister finds out that we've talked to you about this, we will come see you. And you will regret that. And so he went away. My sister didn't find out about this until after she was safely married. Some years later. We're like, hey, you remember that one guy? She's like, yeah. It's like, we told him to go away. My sister was wondering what about one guy that she was like, man, he just seemed to, like, we went out once and he just, that was it. And I was like, well, yeah. I said, well, you remember when he came over to pick you up and you were in the back getting ready? I said, well, we had a talk with him. And we showed him, me, my dad, and my brother, and we showed him the shotguns and the knives and stuff. And I think he understood. But this picture is that her brothers protected her. That was what they did. They protected her. Now remember, she speaks almost resentfully about her brothers at the beginning. You know, when the daughters of Jerusalem are looking at her because she doesn't look like one of the rich young women of Jerusalem, she says, well, my brothers made me keep the vineyards, and so I wasn't able to basically take care of myself. But now notice in verse 10, she says, I am a wall and my breasts like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor. That the result of this protection by her brothers, maybe her father was gone. We don't know. He's never talked about. Her mother and her brothers are talked about, but never her father. But her brothers protected her and watched over her purity. And she says that she found favor in Solomon's eyes because her brothers had protected her so carefully. She uses this, in response to this idea that her brothers had protected her so, she says, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He He let out the vineyard unto keepers, every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. So she writes this story, you know, she says to her husband, you know, you have a vineyard that you let out to somebody else, and they get so much, you get so much, you know. In exchange for their caring for the vineyard, you pay them. She says, my vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. She's not talking about, this is like where she at the beginning said, my own vineyard have I not kept. She's saying, I've given myself to you, and you appreciate who I am because of how well taken care of I was by my brothers. And she's doing this in kind of an indirect way. The Oriental, the Eastern custom is you don't say things directly. That would be considered very crude, very crass. You remember when Abraham was negotiating about how to bury his wife? And they're like, oh, just, you know, just pick a place. And he's like, well, so-and-so has this thing. And they're like, oh, well, what's that between you and me? Take it. And he's like, and I was reading a study on this, and they're saying the guy wasn't really offering to give it for free. He was just following the Eastern custom of being polite. I was reading about this one man who is a diplomat in Japan, and he ended up resigning. He said, because I have the unfortunate ability, I have the unfortunate tendency of saying what I mean in a country when no one ever says what they mean. And so the Oriental custom is to come at things, you know, obliquely, if you want. And so what she's saying here is she's saying, if you're enjoying the vineyard that is me, should not the people who are responsible for bringing me up receive some recompense? So she's urging her husband to take care of, you know, do something nice for her brothers. You know, saying. Solomon's response to her is, thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions hearken to thy voice, cause me to hear it. So instead of answering her directly, he looks on her in delight. This here, you know, he refers back to the fact that here she is, the simple country girl who keeps the gardens and the vineyards and loves growing things. And he says, we love the sound of your voice. Sing for us. That's what he's saying. Sing for us. And the last verse is actually the opening line of a song that she's singing. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. This is the opening of a love song. The conclusion of the Song of Songs is the opening to a love song, inviting Solomon to the full enjoyment of her love. Some things I wanted to point out about this this section is, you know, we see that change in her attitude. She now realizes that those things that when she was younger that she resented, the tight control of her brothers over her, not letting her dress up like a harlot, and that those were for her protection, and that they are the very things that she resented, the protections and restrictions that she resented, are the things that led Solomon to notice her, because she developed into this pure, upright, moral young woman that caught Solomon's attention. I understand, you know, think about Solomon's position, right, as king. Frankly, he's probably seen a lot of trashy women. Because a man of power and wealth like that is not wanting in women throwing themselves at him. Probably everywhere he went, there was some woman making it obvious that he could have whatever he wanted. And so, in light of that, remember when he told her, he talked about how many women there were in Jerusalem, all in the court. And he says, but my beloved is one. She stands out. The virtuous woman stands out among the harlotry of the world. I told Heidi one day, she asked me, you don't mind my being cutesy and stuff and not... She was told that she likes to wear the cutesy socks with the little baubles on them and the little pictures on them. And she likes being the cutesy, you know, person. And she was told by women that she worked with that she had to stop that and she had to dress enticingly and all this stuff if she wanted to keep her man. And I'll tell you frankly what I told her. I said, Heidi, I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I've seen lots of whores. I've seen plenty. I said, what attracted you to me, what attracted me to you, there we go, me to you, was the fact that you were a modest, feminine, virtuous woman. That's why I was interested in. I've seen that, what the world has to offer. Just not interested. And so, sometimes, you know, as parents and as guardians, an individual has to make hard, unpleasant choices. But it is the loving thing to do. Just as the doctor who cuts away the necrotic flesh to save the limb, he is doing something that hurts, that damages the person, but he's doing the thing that is best for them. Sometimes love, you know, love always requires us to do that which is best for the person, but sometimes that is something that is painful for the one loved. You know, Proverbs, it talks about, it says that the wounds of a friend are faithful. That sometimes if we truly love our friends, we have to tell them, say, hey, you're doing wrong. You need to straighten up. Love doesn't always do what is pleasant. It does what is best. And I love the fact of her change of attitude. She realizes, I am the woman who I am. I am the woman who attracted the king of Israel because of the faithfulness of my brothers. You know, we've talked previously about this, that when it comes down to it, what love is, it's seeking that which is best for the one loved, no matter the cost to self. Love isn't always the easy path to follow. Our flesh is constantly tempting us to be self-interested, to be lazy, to not make the sacrifice. Like the Shulamite, when Solomon came to her after they were married, and he came to her, and she didn't want to bother getting out of bed. We're like that all the time. Love comes knocking, calling for us to make the sacrifice, to do the right thing. And we're tempted of our own flesh to do the sinful thing. William, be quiet. Selfish little booger head. Quiets down as soon as mommy gets a hold of him. Spoiled little booger. We'll work on that as he gets older. Right now he doesn't even speak English, so it's kind of limited. But love is about self-sacrifice. This, as I said before, love is the central theme of the Bible. The Bible declares very plain, it says, God is love. Jesus Christ said to his disciples, it says that if you love one another, He says, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. That the greatest thing, the greatest testimony of being a Christian that they could show is by loving one another. Chapter 13, all about love. And it ends with the statement that between faith, hope, and charity, or love, that the greatest of these is love. God in his law, he says that the whole reason for the law, he said that it may be well with you. He says, oh, that there was a heart in you to obey, that it may be well with you. God didn't create the law arbitrarily, trying to be mean, but he loved Israel and wanted to do well for Israel. You hear the heart of the compassion of God in the prophets. It says, oh, why will you die? Speaking to Israel, oh, why will you die? Jesus Christ, how many times I would have gathered you. Oh, Jerusalem, oh, Jerusalem, how many times I would have gathered you under my wings like a mother hen her chicks, but you would not. The love of God over and over again. And of course, the most well-known verse in the world, for God so loved the world. So it should not surprise us that so central a theme should have its own book, the Song of Songs. What is it about? The supremacy of love. If you were to ask me what the theme of the entire book is, it's verse 7 of chapter 8. That love cannot be quenched, and it is of more value than anything could purchase it. I had preached for you guys before from Galatians that the essence of Christian conduct is to serve one another in love. Galatians chapter 5, I forget which verse. I want so badly to just hammer this in, you know, drive this home. I've seen the benefits in my life, and I've seen the negatives of following and not following, you know. Always positive, the following. Always negative, the not following. Truly following love protects you from so many things. Someone one time was talking about that if you were truly selfish, people would take advantage of you. And I made this statement. I said, if you truly follow love and selflessness, you cannot be taken advantage of. Someone said, excuse me? What do you mean by that? And I said, okay. I said, guy comes and he asks for $100. He's like, yeah, yeah. You know, guy comes and asks you for $100. Well, what are you going to do? You're just going to give it to him, right? I'm like, no. I'm not going to just give it to him. Many things here. One, because I follow the path of selflessness, it's not my money. It's God's money. And God has laid out that I'm supposed to do certain things with that money. First off, I'm supposed to take care of my family. And then I'm supposed to take care of the brethren. And then if there's anything left over after that, help others as I have need. But not only that, but I'm supposed to love that individual. And can I love them, giving them $100, and they go out and buy heroin? Is that love? Rather, love will move me to say, why do you need $100? What's the problem? What can I do to fix this? Because I'll tell you what, if somebody doesn't have the money to meet their necessary needs, they're in a lot worse situation than needing a little bit of cash. Something's horribly wrong, and they need help fixing it. And so the whole point is that the path of love is the path. It is the path of righteousness. It is the path of holiness. It is the path of doing things the right way, doing things the best way. And that if you do it any other way, you are setting yourself up for failure, whether that's in your relationship to God, or your relationship to your spouse, or your relationship to your fellow Christians, or your relationship to anybody else in the world. If there is a failure in your relationship, It is because one or more people, you or the other person or both of you, have failed to follow love. This is the way. We should dedicate ourselves to it, absolutely. Thank you for this time. I pray that it has been of a blessing to you. Pastor Weigel?
I thought it was interesting, if we have a little time to bring it out, that a family sometimes goes just one way in trying to deal with the children. And the brothers here are saying that they were using a two-pronged thing. One is the reward of virtuous action. A lot of times we don't see that. Only the barricading of the wrong choices. And I think that's a pretty good insight. Leading people by the reward, by the praise, is a great way of encouraging them to right action.
Yeah, it's something my wife and I have talked about with William, is that we don't, and we did this with our foster children we had. Not only did we censure negative behavior, but we praised positive behavior, especially self-initiated selfless actions, you know, where nobody asked them to do something. And that's one thing, is like sometimes we're so quick. My mother one time said, "You never do anything on your own." I said, "You never give me the opportunity to." I said, "You're always very quick to say, okay, now do this, and do this, and do this, and do this." I said, "You never give me the opportunity to just do the dishes on my own." I said, "I can tell you after you've already commanded me that I was planning on doing the dishes, but what does that mean? And how do you know?" But so that we would sometimes wait to see if the foster child would do something, and then if they didn't, then we would tell them, okay, now you need to do that. But we praised obedience, and we praised self-initiated proper conduct. Anything else, sir? All right. Well, let's close in prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Dear Heavenly Lord, thank you for this time together. Thank you for your word. Pray you bless now and be with us. Be with Pastor Weigel. Pray you use the preaching of your word to minister to each one of us, to help shape us and mold us into the very image of your Son. Bless now, O Father, in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.